Hi, everyone, and welcome to another special Vendée Globe episode of the Yacht Racing Podcast. I'm Justin Chisholm, and joining me again from Lorient in France is ocean racing skipper and past Vendée Globe competitor, Conrad Coleman.
G'day, nice to be here.
Well, Conrad, the skippers are approaching the end of their second week at sea, and yet again, there's been plenty going on out there, hasn't there? A dismasting on one of the foilers, a badly torn mainsail on another boat, and the restart of Jeremy Bayou, and that's just three things I've picked out. Plus, this morning, the leading pack, they're all well over the equator and into the Southern Ocean. Alex Thompson is still leading, but not by too much now. I don't really know where to begin. Should we start with the dismasting and then just go from there?
Sure. Let's start with the bad news and then work towards the front where everybody's having a much better day than sad old Nico Trousseau there. Well, yeah, for those of you that haven't followed the story and may not be completely sort of up to speed on what has been going on with him or the backstory, he was sailing a little bit northwest of the Cape Verdes and was making great inroads into Alex, was absolutely flying along. And he was sailing with one reef and his small Jenica, so that could be called a Code 5 sort of reaching sail. And he was in his bunk with no alarms going on. And then he heard a loud bang and went up on deck and he saw that the mast was over the side and his dreams of this race at least were shattered. It's sort of tough to put that in perspective because one needs to remember that this boat in particular, it's one of the new superfoiling generation, but it was also the newest boat in the fleet. It was put in the water just this spring and then was significantly delayed by COVID and the shutdowns and so on, and has the least number of miles on its keel than the entire fleet. Now, as we saw with Charles and Jeremy Bayou, getting first in the water and getting lots of miles under the boat is not necessarily a guarantee that you're not going to suffer a structural problem as he did. But still, I'm less surprised to see a problem on board Quorum than I was on Charles.
And is there any indication? I mean, you said there were no alarms going off, and for the listeners, the alarms, I think I'm right in saying the alarms are all about the loads on the boat and the rig. So the boat tells the skipper if he's pushing the boat too hard. You said there were no alarms going off, but might he have been pushing too hard, do you think?
Well, that's a really tough question to answer there, Justin, and I'm not just being evasive. Nobody actually knows the answer to that. But to give you a little bit of a historical perspective, back in 2008 and then into 2012, there were lots of dismastings. People were pushing the boundaries of what was technically possible, just a little bit too close to the edge. And as a result, we saw boats that had serial dismastings, like Quito. Quito on board Group Bell, he was chucking his rig over the side sort of once every 3 days, it looked like. And so to put a stop to that, after 2012 there was the implementation of a one design mast tube, and all of the boats have been sailing with exactly the same rig built in here in Lorient by Lorient Mast Spars. But then, of course, between 2012 and 2016, the naval architects got together, sort of scratched their head and said, well, how can we make these boats go faster? Well, what if we put wings out the side? And instead of having a really robust mast that can withstand everything and be the strongest part of the boat, it's now again become a weak link in the whole boat because the dynamic righting moment has made these boats a lot more powerful than even bigger Volvo Ocean Race boats. So you've got these tiny little super lightweight boats that, because they're charging along with these foils, and generating loads that look almost like supermaxis. So they're pretty insane. But of course, then the question is, well, what about Class Amoco? Why don't you come along and build a bigger mast or a stronger mast? And for a long time, I was on the board of directors of the class, and we approached this question several times. And we basically said, well, no, because if we make the mast stronger, well, then first off, you need to replace all of the one design rigs that are already out there. So that's a big sunk cost that goes out the window. And then secondly, well, you unleash the whole cycle again, because you're going to get bigger bigger foils and boats that are going even faster. And we're already concerned about the skippers on board the boats getting hurt and the boats just becoming unwieldy. So what we said was, okay, boys, here are the parameters of the loads that this mast can withstand. Build your boat around that, and if you go beyond it, well, it's on you, or you need to be extremely delicate in the way that you treat it, and thus my reference to alarms. All of the boats have completely covered themselves with load sensors and fiber optics, and they're constantly analyzing and calculating the righting moment on board the boats and whether the rig is in danger. So the thing, and this is purely me sort of reading between the lines, is but it's possible that because Quorum was the boat that had the least number of miles on it, maybe they hadn't yet calibrated all of those systems, or they just needed more data. You know, data is king. Or maybe there was a fault in a component. But because Nico had to chuck the whole rig over the side and in order to save the hull and then turn around and motor back to Mindelo in the Cape Verdes, it's really sort of hard to truly do an accurate post-mortem on what actually happened.
But it's worrying, isn't it, for the rest of the skippers, because what you've effectively described with these masts is that the mast is the fuse.
Yes.
You can load the boat up until it becomes too much for the rig, and then the rig fails, and that's the end of it. But because all the rigs are the same, the news of this dismasting must have gone through the fleet like a shock, because we saw Alex Thompson on video when he was informed, you know, just hours after it had happened, and he looked genuinely shocked. And I think, you know, a little disappointed for his kind of fellow competitor, but also was, you could see the cogs turning in his head of, oof, this is the first one of the rigs to fail in this race.
Yeah, that's very definitely the case. It's, you know, one must remember that, of course, we're doing sort of, the sailors doing bare knuckle boxing out there, and they're fighting to eke out the smallest advantage. But we all live in the same town here in Lorient. Our kids play together. We all know each other very, very well. Obviously, Alex is the exception to that, but he's still part of the fraternity of the Amoco sailors. And you know, we all know how hard it is to build these campaigns, and it's brutal having them fall apart like that. So obviously there's the sort of human sympathy that goes out to our skippers, but then there's also the question of, well, you know, could this happen to me? I'm on a WhatsApp group, and there was a flurry of activity between all of the skippers, sort of chucking ideas back and forwards and wondering what had actually happened. So for sure, for the sailors out there, this is definitely weighing on them, and maybe they're gonna, you know, dial up the sensitivity on their load sensing equipment and you know, not push quite as hard as they were playing around. So we'll see how that works. Yeah. It's tough to think of backing off when we're seeing the incredible speeds at the front of the fleet now, and seeing how hard these guys are pushing and how close their speeds are.
So a little nervous times for the skippers, but for Mr. Trussell, he's got the good news is he's safe. He wasn't injured in the incident and the boat is intact. And I think I read this morning that he's actually at the Cape Verde Islands now. He's anchored off. So what happens now? What swings into action from the team? Because they need to get that boat back to somewhere, to the mainland, basically.
Well, yeah, you're right. You're right to talk about the team. He apparently arrived at exactly the same time as his technical team sort of flew in from Europe. Of course, a challenging time to be flying in right now with all of the COVID restrictions, but they arrived here to rendezvous together. I've been to Mindelo in Cape Verdes, and it's an incredibly beautiful town, but it's Cape Verdes has a very rich combined history between the sort of Portuguese colonial roots and also the African inspiration. And you've got these sort of brightly colored wooden fishing boats, and then every once in a while when there's a problem, you get these sort of carbon fiber French spaceships that sort of rock up in Tethys, like Coram hit. So sort of, I'm sure that we'll be seeing some interesting photos when the team swings into action. Basically, what they need to do is they need to flag down a passing cargo ship. Probably the easiest thing to do is to pick the boat up with a crane, take the keel off, and then flat pack it on the deck of the cargo ship and send it back to Lorient, where they'll order a new rig and start working towards the route to rum in 2 years' time so he can have his appropriate revenge.
This may be a tenuous link, but I'm... You know, the other big ocean race is the Ocean Race, formerly the Volvo Ocean Race, and that race will stop in the Cape Verdes on the 2022 edition, which still seems like a long way in the future. And we have an IMOCA class in that race. I wonder whether some of the boats that have bailed out early from, or subsequently end up bailing out early from this Vendée Globe, whether the Ocean Race might now start to come into focus in their plans for future projects, because I mean these are still very viable boats, aren't they?
Yeah, that's certainly true. It's tough though. Yeah, it's a tough marriage to get the single-handed sailing, which is primarily French in culture, French in language, French in approach, into the very sort of English Anglo world. There's sort of lots of head scratching when you're putting those two worlds together. But what's challenging is that the Vendée Globe boats are steered by their very, very advanced autopilots for 95% of the time, at least. It's pretty rare that that the skipper on board can outperform the pilot, certainly in the long term. So maybe you'll surf a few waves for a couple of hours, and hang on to it. To a Jenica on the top end of its range as a gust comes through, but primarily they are steered by the autopilots. And the cabin ergonomics are all built around that idea, is that you put your tiller extension on the tiller, you sort of push it into a corner, and then it's all about protecting the skipper and keeping them out of the elements and letting the pilot do his thing. So basically, to convert a solo sailing boat into an ocean racing boat is that you need to accommodate five more people on board, because it's five sailors plus a media man on some legs, I believe. And then you need to get the boat configured so that it can be driven by a helmsperson for the majority of the time. There it's going to be switched. It's going to be driven 95% of the time by a human. And then because the boat's relatively short-handed, they do allow you to turn on the autopilot, but only in relatively basic compass mode. So it's really there just as a backup, or just as there for a few minutes while the rest of the team does their thing. So for sure, it's fantastic. It's a really cool collaboration between two very, very different worlds. I'm super excited to see what these boats look like when they're fully powered up and thrashed by a full crew. But it's not like you can take one from solo sailing world and then 2 weeks later, put a full crew on it. There's a lot of work to go into optimizing it, but it can still be done. So we'll see if Coram wants to do that. It depends on whether their interests extend to sort of a global audience, or whether there's value there for the sponsors. That's also one of the challenges of getting the current Vendée fleet into the Ocean Race, is that we've got relatively small provincial French sponsors. Often the campaigns are shared by multiple sponsors. For example, Fabrice Amadeo comes to mind. His boat looks like logos have just been sort of scattershot all over his boat. And so whether they have an interest in going around the world and doing B2B in the Cape Verdes, that remains to be seen. But good question. It's an exciting time to get these worlds together.
For sure. Now, with one sailor stopping, we've got another sailor restarting. I think we both will have been pleased to see the news that Jeremy Bayou has decided to rejoin the race. In fact, he did that on Wednesday. He's starting off a long, long, long way behind the fleet. I think the leaders were going through the doldrums, were nearly over the equator when he set off from Le Sable d'Olonne on Wednesday afternoon. You were kind of tuned into that quite closely. Was it possible to learn any more about what the damage was and what they needed to do to the boat, or was that all kept under wraps?
There's been no official explanation as to how much work needed to be done. And I've got lots of buddies in the team, but I didn't want to bother them while they were there in Lissabon. I gave them a quick call to say, you know, congrats, good job for getting the boat out there again, but didn't ply them with details. But I think that we can see the soundness of Jeremy's decision to come back and give the boat back to his technical team, just by the fact that it took his full team 3.5 days of round-the-clock work to get the boat ready for sea again. So I think that we can put to rest any possible idea that he could have done that out there by himself. And so that puts him in a very, very challenging, very new space for him, because he's been dreaming about winning this race, having been on the podium 4 years ago. This is his fourth participation. He has lived and breathed this race full time for the majority of his career. And now, well, he's not going out there as an adventurer, quote unquote, because he's still got one of the fastest boats in the fleet. But you know, winning is off the table. But he's going to be chasing the fleet down, and I'm sure that he's going to be sort of picking boats off relatively soon. You know, he's a lot faster than the tail end Charlies at the moment, so he will be getting back into it. However, you know, it's inevitable that we make the comparisons to previous boats that have done U-turns. You know, back in 2000, Mike Golding dismasted on the first night, went back, made it back to the side of the loan. They stepped his spare rig, and he started, I think, a week later and finished seventh. And then, even more famously, we had Michel Lejoie in 2008, who flooded his engine on the first night, went back, started a day later, and then won the race overall. But I think that while the principle of, sure, doing a U-turn and then catching up and getting into the top 10 or winning the race is a great storyline, there are significant differences in this case. One is that Jeremy was already well past Cap Finisterre and had gone through two cold fronts by the time that he sustained this damage. And then when Michel Desjoyeaux came back, he came back for 3 hours while his team rebuilt the engine and got him sorted again, and he was off on the next tide, whereas Jeremy started a full 10 days behind the race, and his boat was immobilized for 3.5 days. So he really does have a huge mountain to climb. And I think that... I know that Michel Desjoyeaux in interviews has said himself that there are more differences in their stories than there are similarities. But it's going to be interesting to see what Jeremy does out on the race course, where he ends up by the time they end up back in the Sable d'Olonne in the rankings. And crucially, how much of a window into his world he is able to give us as fans, because maybe he'll take us along for the ride and give us a little bit of a peek behind the curtain as to what Jeremy is really like now that he has less pressure on the shoulders.
Yeah, maybe he will open up a little more now that he's not in contention to win. We say he's not in contention to win. Of course, this is the Vendée Globe, and anything can happen. Let's not rule it out completely. Just quickly, Conrad, in terms of the weather, it was a pretty slow start for the fleet when he was out there the first time. Do things look any better with the trade winds for him? Is he going to get to the equator a bit quicker than he would have done the first time?
Well, yeah, I think despite the fact that the boats are significantly faster than they were 4 years ago, take note of the fact that Alex was first at the equator and he was behind his own record time. So they really haven't had optimal conditions and thus far in the race. And looking at the weather that he has at the moment, and there's a beautiful high pressure over us in Lorient right now, and that is feeding sort of relatively standard conditions. So he is currently blazing down the coast of Portugal, heading towards the Canaries, and you can see that if you go and look at the route, that his trace, his the route that he's leaving behind him is a lot straighter, a lot smoother, a lot less tortured than the boats that went through the first time. So he does look like he's making really good progress. And in many ways, the weather does look a lot more friendly for him. There is a little tropical wave over the Canaries at the moment, but by the time that he gets there, I think that he'll still have pretty stable conditions. So,
well, as we do with Mr. Trousseau and Mr. Bayer, we wish them both the very best with what happens next for them. Let's take a look now at the race itself, because at the front of the fleet, it's been kind of not the best news for Alex Thompson. He's still leading this morning, but he had a lead of nearly 100 nautical miles. And now I'm looking at it, it looks like it's down to just a handful of miles. What's going on? And what happened with the doldrums?
Yeah, well, first off, the doldrums were a very quick and easy, relatively painless passage, both for the leaders and also, well, a little bit more complicated for those behind. But basically, when you think about the doldrums, the intertropical convergence zone, is that you have the southern hemisphere high pressure system that is turning in an anti-clockwise direction, and the northern hemisphere that is turning in a clockwise direction. And so it's kind of like two cog wheels meshing together. But as they come together, there's this sort of tortured zone where the two weather systems are in conflict. So that basically you have southeasterlies coming up from the south, and you've got northwesterlies coming from the other side. Northeasterlies, excuse me. And as well as incredibly hot, bubbly energy, because you're really close to the equator, and that's obviously we've got lots of thermal energy as well. And so that creates this really turbulent, really unpredictable zone that is frankly not well modeled by the weather models. And so the sailors sort of go back to using the infrared satellite images that are sent down to them, and then also the radar to track individual squalls. And historically, this has been really challenging, both back in the days of yore, but also last year, for example, Charles went into the doldrums with a 100-mile lead and came out 3 days later, with a 300-mile deficit, and he went from largely winning the Transaxia Kebab to coming third. Mm. So the stakes are really high, and it was astonishing to see the boat slip through without stopping. They slowed down to 10 or 15 knots, and then they were back up to 20. Watching what they've been doing in the southeast trades and heading towards Brazil, it looks like Alex Thompson has been sailing a lower course. And so he's been sailing a little bit deeper, heading more towards the west than the two chasing boats, Charlie Dalla and Thomas Hunyon, who've been sailing tighter, faster angles. At times they've been 4 or even 5 knots faster than him. And I'm surprised that making the investment towards the west was worth it to Alex, to let that speed deficit last for so long. But in explaining that, maybe it's a long-term strategic choice to be further to the west, that he sees a chance closer to the Brazilian coast to line up for what's to come in the South Atlantic. Maybe Alex was just completely destroyed by all of the energy that he's given in the first part of the race, and he used that time to sleep and to be sort of less on it than he has been previously. Or a combination of factors could be just that his boat is so optimized for running conditions that we've seen that the hull forms of both Verdier boats are very different from the VPLP skinny running boat that Hugo Boss has. That maybe the other boats were just faster in these conditions, and that's when they could light it up. So the choice of route, choice of energy, choice of setting yourself up for what's to come, all of this has undoubtedly come to play that they've tightened things up. However, All of that to say that it's not actually as bad for Alex Thompson as it may seem on the rankings. And that's because the rankings are established from a point in the middle of largely in the middle of the Atlantic on an approximate route as to where the boats have gone historically. But that point is a long way further east of where the boats are now. And so that means that a boat that is a little bit north of Alex, like the two guys that are chasing him, but a little bit further east, is going to be counted more favorably on the rankings, because at the moment the boats are basically off course from what's expected. Right. So while it may be just a handful of miles on the ranking, what really counts is their north-south separation. And for me, Alex has still got, I just measured a couple of minutes ago, 50 or 60 miles on the guys chasing him, measured north-south, and that's what really counts. So he's right. Still got a pretty good buffer, but given the speed that these boats go, 50 or 60 miles can be wiped out in the afternoon. So.
Well, that's pretty key information to communicate, and that's going to be good stuff for the Yacht Club bar, if anybody's still allowed to go to the Yacht Club bar, and just drop that one into the conversation when somebody else says what I did, that Alex's lead is down to just a few miles.
Yeah, exactly. So that's the north-south separation counts for gold at the moment.
So that point that they're racing to, I guess, moves ahead of them around the world. So once they get close to that, they move
exactly.
On.
The way that it's done is that the mapping system is done by a French company called Geovoile, and what they do is, instead of having sort of 5 points that are used to calculate as they go around the world, you know, it'd be very easy to just to put a ranking point on the Cape of Good Hope and then another one on the bottom of New Zealand and another one on Cape Horn, is that in order to try and make it more accurate and actually avoid these kind of conversations, is that they've got a sliding ranking system that with a series of waypoints that sort of update automatically as the fleet advances along the course. But you do inevitably end up with a few of these moments, and typically it is in the South Atlantic that this shows up, where it's not only the north-south spread, but the east-west spread that counts.
Okay. Now, it seems to me that the foilers are coming to the fore now. The boats are into this more trade-windy conditions, even though it doesn't seem to be the full trade winds, is what I interpret from what the skippers are telling us. But this is good for the foilers, isn't it? And we've seen Jean Lacam start to slip back on his non-foiling boat. Do we just see the foilers stretch away now for the rest of the race?
Yeah, I think that's inevitable. You know, just to give you some idea of the last 24 hours, Hugo Boss has done 479 miles. Lefty Out has done 481. Pivia has done 499. So that's an average of 24 hours of well over 20 knots. Which is seriously quick. In comparison, Jean Lacam has done 400 nautical miles, and so definitely more pedestrian. You know, that's 20% down on his foiling buddies. And when they're in these trade wind conditions, and particularly when they're in these sort of reaching conditions, then there's nothing that his boat can do. You know, that he's on his fifth race, not just race around the world, his fifth Vendée Globe. He knows this boat like the back of the hand. He's going to be sailing at the absolute limit of its theoretical capacity, and he's bringing a knife to a gunfight at this point. So,
just tell me something a little bit about these two chasing boats. We talked a bit about Apivia and Linked Out in terms of the boat and the designer, but the skippers themselves. You've got Charlie Dallin on Apivia, who's a rookie in the race, so he's probably being a little more cautious, is he, than you know. We've got Alex there, who's the wily old fox, who's on his fifth lap of the world, or fifth race at least. I just wonder, is Alex thinking, yeah, you guys can push as hard as you like, but I know what I'm doing here. I'm gonna just keep my powder dry.
Well, my counter argument to that is that Apivia has been the fastest in the last 24 hours out of those three boats. Yes, Charlie is a Vendée Globe rookie, but he has done the Jacques Vabre, the Transat Jacques Vabre that goes to the Brazilian coast, several times as co-skippers on the first as a co-skipper before he had his own program, and then he won, don't forget, the Transaction Club a year ago with a pretty strong lead and a very strong performance on a new boat. So, and then also just to give a little bit of historical perspective, Charlie and I did the mini Transat back in 2009, going to Bahia down on the South Brazilian coast as well. And so we were both sailing minis then. He won the leg two into Brazil across the Atlantic, and almost won the mini overall, actually. So, you know, he knows these waters well, and even though this is his first full circumnavigation, at least up until Bahia or Itajaí on the Brazilian coast, he knows where he is. So, Toma, of course, is in his second Vendée Globe, his second circumnavigation. Those two boats are very, very similar. They're inspired by the Super 60 cycle of design work done by Jan Verdier and his team for the proposed Super 60 for the Ocean Race. They're very powerful. They're very fast boats. They're very different, in fact, from Hugo Boss. And so that's why I think that we're seeing differences in these region conditions. But the architectural bet that the team of Hugo Boss has made is that they're going to be spending more time running and less time reaching. And when they get into the south, then we'll see how that shapes up when the angles change.
So let's have a look at what we should be looking out for in the coming week as the skippers get further into the south. Is it too early to start talking about the infamous St. Helena High? And hopefully it's not. It's one of my favorites. I always enjoy the boats negotiating this on the Volvo.
Well, I'm pleased that you do, because it's an absolute nightmare when you're actually out there.
I'm sure it is. But it's just like a huge car park, isn't it, for yachts, if you get
Yeah, either it's a car park or it's a motorway. It changes its mood faster than you can change your clothes. What's crucial, the leading boats are in an absolute crucial moment right now. They could move into a separate meteorological system relative to those behind, and you could have the top five separate themselves from the rest of the fleet definitively right here in the next few days. And the reason for that is that the St. Helena High is compressed, and you've got a relatively stable field of wind in the northern part of the South Atlantic, but then you've got this little low that's been birthed off the coast of South America, and that's what is creating this sort of cold frontal region that the leaders are charging into right now. And the big question over this weekend and into Monday is whether they are able to stay in front of that and staying in front of that front as that low slowly moves eastwards over the South Atlantic. And if they can stay in front of the front, I'm sorry, that sounds complicated, but that's what needs to happen, then they're going to run away with this race and they'll never be seen again. However, as the St. Helena High readjusts after being pushed around and abused by this little low, it will expand back over the South Atlantic basin and will either trap them or will certainly trap the boats just behind them. So the next few days, it's an absolute, the race is on to stay in front of the system, but it's gonna be very, very complicated in the first part of the next week as to how they connect into the stronger winds of the South Atlantic and the Southern Ocean.
Fantastic. You heard it here first. This is a crucial moment coming up in the race. Conrad, thank you so much for your expert insight as ever. We will speak again next week. And for those people listening to the podcast, don't forget to check out Conrad's weekly column on the Yacht Racing Life website, More Fantastic Insight, and getting some really good responses to that. So thank you for that. Until next week, Conrad, I'll say cheers.
Pleasure. Thank you.